Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So we're over halfway through the retreat now, day six. And I think it's benefiting all of us, not just all of you, but us monastics as well, Longpa and Ajahn Gurudamo and Debbie get to have a break from their various administrative duties in the monastery, and then myself, Tankovilo, Anagarika Anthony, also having various responsibilities, get to take a break. And it's also a very nice group here. It's a feeling of family, lots of familiar faces, and some new faces as well. And it's a sense of sangha as far as being a field of merit or a field of blessings. And in the chanting in the morning and evening, we say the sangha is punya keta, which we translate as bringing incomparable goodness, allowing that to arise in the world. But punya keta, punya is merit and keta means field. So literally the sangha is a merit field. And you're planting blessings, reaping the fruits of blessings and goodness in the sangha. And I also like to think of, well, one of the reasons I came to ordain is just seeing really clearly that being in the circle of the Dhamma and the Sangha, just the ideal circumstance for making lots of good karma. And just when we take on precepts, whether it's the 5, 8, or 10, or the 227 precepts, then any circumstance in our life, we can be building barami, or spiritual perfection, whether we're meditating or working or looking after the monastery, or if we don't live in the monastery, then just looking after our daily life. If we're keeping precepts, then anything in our life can be used for the cultivation of parami. But then we come into to retreat, and a 10-day retreat like this, and it's then giving importance to the formal practice, sitting meditation, walking meditation, listening to Dhamma. And so, yeah, nurturing, taking care of the core of our practice, focusing a bit more intensively for a period of time. Especially this retreat. Today's the day before Thanksgiving. And maybe a number of you are familiar with the 8 precepts and have followed them before. But if it's new for some people, then this is a very unusual thing to be doing coming up to Thanksgiving. Not eating dinner, being restrained with food. And is that real sense of going against the stream of the world. Just meditating, eating between dawn and noon, just living simply and listening to teachings, making the heart bright and peaceful, and being filled with contentment and well-being. That's something probably not many people are experiencing on Thanksgiving. So it's going against the stream of the world. I was trying to think of what to talk about in the last day or two, and I don't know why, but what was coming up, I guess it was just listening to a lot of the questions and actually really looking forward to the question and answer sessions. And I guess for a lot of people, there's a desire to be understood, and that happens a lot in the monastery too, the monastic community. I can't even count how many times since I've entered the community thinking, this person misunderstands me, this person doesn't understand me. And say, difficult interactions, or somebody seems to just always rub you the wrong way. And so it's a great blessing to have the Dhamma teachings, because we use those in order to learn from our life and community. And one thing that's interesting about that desire to be understood is because it's interesting because if we want to be understood, we have to be willing to understand others. And usually it's very one-sided, just wanting to be understood. But if somebody's mistreated us or criticized us or, you know, mocked us or embarrassed us or any number of things that may be negative as far as interpersonal interactions, it's good to ask oneself, have I ever done that to anybody else? And then we reflect on karma in that way. Well, if I've done that to other people in the past, so that why am I upset that that's happening to me now? And this can come up really strong while meditating too, because these unresolved events in our life seem to pop up to the surface during the formal meditation. And memories, painful memories, or painful ways we relate to ourselves, they pop up during the meditation. They come to the surface, and then that resentment or the anger or the irritation might be renewed temporarily, and chew on it for a little while. And it's good to come back to that. Well, what about, did I ever do that to anybody else in the past? And so Dharma Master Hung Shur, talking about this, is returning the light, shining it back on ourselves. Or Ajahn Chah, there's a teaching Ajahn Chah gave where he said, when you're practicing and you're living in community, you should be focusing on your own mind, your own actions, 90%. Don't be always trying to find fault with others. Don't be trying to focus on others. And don't be trying to use the precepts as a weapon to criticize others. Only focusing on others maybe 10%, and focusing on ourselves 90%. So returning the light and coming back to what have we done to others in the past, and we may feel we've been mistreated or treated unfairly, unjustly. But I'm trying to remember back, have we ever treated anybody else like that? This came up for me a few times recently, and somebody relating to me in the monastery with what I felt was like disrespect or mockery, a tone of mockery. And then I thought, that's really unfair. I'm really nice to this person. Why are they treating me like this? And then I thought, oh, you know, in the past I have treated people like that before, so I can just accept that. That's my It's my karma. Those are seeds I've already planted, so I'm just reaping the results of those. And if I don't interact, don't react to that, or just return the light of awareness back on myself, then I can liberate that karma. I don't have to keep that cycle going. I can end it with that. Just accept the results and then move on. It's one helpful way of relating to difficult mental states, difficult memories, perceptions that come up when we're meditating. But also keeping the perspective of Dhamma, as far as the perspective that in the light of that birth, aging, sickness, and death, then these lots of our interactions in life, which we make a big deal out of, or which seem like a really big deal, then they aren't such a big deal when we think about death, for example. Or if we have an experience of death, then everything else becomes really small, and that single experience comes to the forefront. And then it's kind of like, why was that so important? Why was I worrying about that? What was that anxiety all about? And yeah, I know lots of people in this room have had experiences with death. And Debbie was talking about an experience with her mother. And I know other people in this room. I know someone in this room who's lost his mother to a tragic car accident. And there's other examples in this room. So many, many people here, probably almost everybody, if not everybody, has been touched by death in some way. And when that happens, there's something that shifts in the mind. And if we read about death, or we read a book about relating to death, we have a grieving process. And so when death happens, then there's a grieving process, and then it's like, if it's a friend, it might take 1 year. If it's a relative, it might take 2 or 3 years. Or you might have these numbers, which you're supposed to get over it after a period of time. But really, I think what happens is you never really get over it. You just, when you experience death, you just shift into a different mode of being, and you never really go back from that. So I thought, since it's a group of familiar people, I'd just share my own experience with death when I was living at Pujamgam. And this happened in April 2012. So it's still kind of fresh in my memory. And I was living at Pujamgam, this little branch monastery of Wat Nanachat that Ajahn Pasano started in 1990, 1991, something like that. And it's a very remote little monastery on the Mekong River, looking over Laos, so it's in eastern Thailand, Ubon province, and very beautiful location, a lot of sandstone and caves, in a really nice grass roof meditation hall. And so everything's basically outside, and I really enjoyed living there. I lived there for over 2 years. And so it was myself, and then there was a monk named Tananalio, just junior to me, and then another monk, Tanvisalo, Indonesian monk. It was the three of us. We'd been living together for maybe 3 or 4 months. Really harmonious, really good little group. And then there's Tanjoti Panyo came to visit. He has two vasas at the time, and this Canadian man, a Canadian monk who was at Abhayagiri. We tend to spend our third vasa away for a year. So Ajahn Kevali at Wat Nanachat, he's been taking up this practice as well, and sometimes sending monks away for their third vasa. So Tanjoti Panyo was going to return to Canada and live with Ajahn Viradamo at Tisarana Monastery, and he had his ticket to go back, and Pujum Gam was always his favorite place to practice. So he wanted to visit for a week or two before heading back to Canada. And he's really quiet monk, really well-liked in the Sangha, junior monk. And so Ajahn Kivli called me and asked if Jyoti Panyo could come for a week or two. I was really happy. Just, yeah, of course. Yeah, Jyoti Panyo can come here anytime. And so so he came. So then there was a group of four of us. And I remember it really clearly because then it was Songkran, which is Thai New Year's. And Pujum Gam is probably one of the hottest places in Thailand in the hot season. And you just have the rocks and not many trees, very, very small little trees. And at during the day, it's maybe up to 100 degrees or just over 100 degrees. But then the rocks are black and they soak up all that heat, and then at night they're like an oven and they just radiate heat all night. So it'd be maybe 95, 96 degrees all night, and you're just sweating all night. So a lot of Nanachat monks would feel that they were being punished if they were sent to Pujum Gam in a hot season. But I really liked it. I spent three consecutive hot seasons there. So it was Songkran, Thai New Year's, which is like a water festival. So you drive down the highway and people are launching, like throwing buckets of water at your car when you're driving down the highway, or you're walking through the village and everybody's spraying each other with water. And then one of the things that they would do at Pujum Gam, they just keep it very simple. We just have a hand-washing ceremony, like a symbolic bathing of the monks. So it's just, they would have like flower-scented water, and we'd do some paritta chanting, and then they just pour the water over our hands. So Jyoti Panyo was there with us for that. And then the last day of Songkran, it goes for 3 days. So it's like April 13th, 14th, 15th. And so on the last day, we had this ceremony. And that was his last full day alive. And so we had that hand-washing ceremony. And then the next day, April 16th, we had the meal. And then after the meal, I remember he offered me coffee, and it was really nice. And we were just sitting down. He wanted to sit down and chat about, how to be. He was going to go visit his parents, and how to be at home, and how to keep different precepts. And he just had various questions about like allowables and different precepts that might get broken. Things not getting properly offered, and things like that when he's at home. And so, I just remember sitting down with him and chatting in this back room in the meditation hall, having coffee, really nice. And it's interesting to think back on that, because that's the last time I spoke to him. And we don't usually think when we meet somebody, like, that's the last time I'm going to see them alive, or that's the last time I'm going to speak to them. And then he'd only been at Pujum Gam for about 4 days. And then I remember coming out for tea, and he wasn't there. And then I, Tananalio, the other monk there, he loves working, so he was pushing a cart full of rocks around and just because. And I called out to him, did you see Jyoti? Did he come to tea today? And he said, no, I haven't seen him. So I thought, oh, that's strange, because he usually, Tantri Tipanya was usually someone who just always kept the schedule, and then when there wasn't anything to do, he would just go meditate. So I thought, oh, that's kind of strange. He's not here for tea, but he's probably having a good meditation. He was staying in a nearby cave, maybe a 10-minute walk from the main meditation hall. And so I didn't think anything of it. But then the next morning, we would set up the Dhamma hall for the meal at about 5 a.m. and then go alms around in the village. And he wasn't there, which was really unusual. And so I said, you guys go ahead, you guys go alms around. I'm going to go check on Jyoti. I'm a bit worried about him. And so the other two went alms around, and I walked out to the cave, and it was really kind of surreal, just a very, very beautiful morning, and just sunrise at Pujamgam is always really incredible, and just walking out there, and then there's a kuti, like a grass roof hut, above this cave, and then there's a cave down below it. We called it the Lena Cave, and so I was calling out, yeah, Jyoti, are you there? And there was no response, and so I went down into the cave, and then I saw his body just face down in the cave, lying face down, and then it's kind of in shock. I kept reliving that moment later, just seeing someone, and it's kind of like you don't want to believe it, but then my first reaction is run up and like, well, he must be alive, and then looking down, it's like, There's ants on the body, there's flies, and it's kind of like, get down, and it's like, come on, it's scraping the ants off. And then after a few seconds, I look, and some of the skin was coming off, and my hand had some blood on it. I thought, okay, he's dead, and he's been dead for quite some time, probably since the day before. So I kind of took a few deep breaths, and I just went right into practical mode. I didn't really feel emotional, but I was kind of, there was some adrenaline coming up, and I was kind of shaking a bit. But otherwise, I was able to, like, okay, I have to deal with this situation. I have a cell phone with me. Okay, call the abbot of Wat Nanachat. Call the head villager who helps look after Pujamgam. And so I was standing there, and it was this beautiful morning, and then there's this dead body, someone who was a friend. And so then the villagers got the other two monks from alms around and drove them back to the monastery. And they were also really good friends with Jyoti Panyo. So then they got back, and it was like we all walked out together. And then they announced it in the village. It's a big deal. A Westerner dying in Thailand. So they announced it in the village. And then we couldn't really move the body, because they have to send out all sorts of different authorities when a Westerner dies in Thailand. So we just had to wait there, and there was probably like 100 villagers who ended up walking out to the cave, and then we were out there long enough, they started setting up little like drink stands, and they brought food with them, and everybody was sitting around on the rocks in little circles. And then eventually the authorities showed up. But that was a really special time, that few hours where me and the other two monks, we were just sitting with the body. For maybe 2 or 3 hours, we were there with the body. And it's really interesting. It wasn't really strong emotions, but it was just kind of like, looking at that image. And then kind of getting burned into the mind. And then, of course, the mind goes to, well, what happened? So we're trying to figure out what happened. And it seemed he just... There's kind of a walking meditation path in this overhang, it's kind of a cave, it's a big rock overhang, and there's a walking meditation path, and then there's about a 2-foot drop from the walking meditation path onto a rock, which is kind of sloped downward, just a big flat rock. And it seems he took a dead fall, standing straight up. He's taller than I am, and he's a big guy. So it seems his body somehow went rigidly straight, and he took a dead fall and just hit his head on the rock really, really hard. And there was a river of blood coming out from his head, and there was no movement since that fall. It was obvious that it happened pretty quick, and probably the best assessment was he had some sort of aneurysm, and just his body went rigid, and he just took a dead fall. And so his mind is trying to figure out what happened, but yeah, it was really interesting just being there with. And it's different than if there's warning or if there's an illness and you have time to prepare. There's things to think through. This is just very sudden and very, very unexpected. So it's got kind of a different energy. Then it was time for the meal, and we pushed the meal back a bit. Usually at Pujumgon we would eat at about 8 a.m., but I think we had it at 8:30 or 9, and the kitchen had still made a meal for us, and so the authorities weren't ready to move the body yet. They were waiting for the coroner and whatnot, and so we went out and had a short meal, and then it's kind of like, well, let's, you know, the merit of this meal, of course, goes to Tanjo Di Panyo, and so then shortly after the meal, I was only probably able to eat a few bites. Could barely eat anything, and then it's just like, you know, walk back out there. And eventually, they're able to pick up the body and move him to the sala, to the Dhamma hall. And by that time, Ajahn Kevali had, the abbot of Wat Nanachat, he had shown up with another monk from Wat Nanachat. And so we took the body to the Dhamma hall. And it's a two-story Dhamma hall, so we put him downstairs, and the smell was actually quite strong, and laid him on a kind of bed type thing, and then did some paritta chanting, did funeral chanting, and then the ambulance was there, so then we were able to take him straight to Wat Nanachat, where he would be cremated. But of course, having to think through, okay, now we have to contact his parents and tell the family, so that's a whole other kind of ordeal. But yeah, and he had a lot of good friends at Wat Nanachat, so the people who ordained with him and were just a little bit senior or a little bit junior to him were able to try to help clean the body. And there was a lot of ants, and there was some... the eyes were already had like maggots in them, and so quite difficult cleaning them up. But I think it was good that that his friends got to clean the body rather than the hospital people doing it. And then we had a refrigerated coffin, and the hospital people were trying to put formaldehyde into the body to help preserve for a few days when we'd be able to do cremation at Wat Nanachat. And it was difficult because if a body's been dead for longer than 12 hours, then the veins collapse and they can't inject the formaldehyde, so that it actually wasn't taking. And so then we just had to hope for that the refrigerated coffin would be cold enough to stop any decomposition that was happening. And it actually didn't help very much. There was quite a strong smell in the Wat Nanachat sala for about 3 days, but people were still able to come in and pay respects to the body and get their minds around it. And it was also, it turned out that his mother was very understanding, gave permission to cremate the body, and she's just an incredible woman, Gail. And she had been at Pujumgam the previous November, so I had met her, which was actually really helpful. And Tanjo Dipanyo had taken her out to the cave where he was to pass away. And he had told his mother that this cave here is the only place I've ever felt happy in my life. And so his mother, that was very helpful for her to know that he had died in one place where he had felt truly happy in his life, because he had a really hard life. He'd dealt with suicidal depression, and being a monk was really working out well for him. But yeah, he had told his mother that about the cave, so she took solace in that memory. His father had a harder time. Mother and father separated. His father was very close with him, and he's quite a bit older. He's maybe in his 80s, but he was basically very distraught and ended up having to be hospitalized, basically just with a broken heart, basically. So that was very difficult, but he also recovered. And also it was really interesting to see the coming together. I mean, Lungpor Sumedho and lots of senior monks and just an incredible coming together at Wat Nanachat for this death. And also one thing that really struck me about this was how monks who have had long-standing kind of difficulties with each other coming together and working together and being completely harmonious in this event of a fellow bhikkhu dying. It's really lovely to see. So a lot of people spreading metta to each other, and the anger and past criticism and difficulties with each other, they were all just set aside in the light of this event. And so then Lungpa Liam came to visit Wat Nanachat, and he's kind of looking after, setting up for the funeral, and he's just very practical. And I remember sitting down in the evening with him at Wat Nanachat, and we were all asking questions about this, and showing him pictures that were taken of the body at the cave at Pujumgam. And somebody asked Lungpa Liam, isn't this is just an incredible occurrence. I mean, it's really unusual because he's only the third non-Thai monk in the Ajahn Chah group who's ever died in the robes. There's been Westerners who have left the robes and died after that, but I think he's only the third who's actually died in the robes in the Ajahn Chah group as far as being a non-Thai person. And so we're telling Lungpa Liam this, and he just said, it's actually it's not strange at all. This is the most ordinary thing in the world. And just doesn't matter how you die. If you're born, you die. That's how you look at it with Dhamma. And from a worldly perspective, that doesn't sound right. But if you investigate it, it's the truth. And that is the way it is. Birth is the cause and death is the inevitable result. And so it's the most normal, most ordinary thing in the world. And Lungpa Liam went on to say that on top of that, it's a great blessing that he died in the robes, because it's actually rare in the world for a monk to stay as a monk long enough to die in the robes. So that's a great blessing as well. And yeah, and for myself, after all the practical things were taken care of, I did get a bit emotional, but nothing too extreme. But But then as time went on and things settled out, normalized after that, I found that this event was just incredibly helpful for my practice. And I'm sure other monks who knew him experienced this as well. Because one is just this sense of urgency. It's like, who's next? And, you know, anything could happen to anybody. And although it doesn't seem to happen that often yet, but, you know, still, we don't know. Anything could happen. There was, having plans doesn't stop death. So, you know, he had a very clear plan to, had tickets to go to Canada, so. So it's, what this brings up for me is kind of like the Bodega Rata Sutta, one fortunate day. And it's some short verses from the Buddha saying, let not a person revive the past or on the future build their hopes. For the past has been left behind, future has not yet been reached. Instead, with insight, let them see each presently arisen state. Let them know that and be sure of it, invincibly, unshakably. And today the effort must be made. Tomorrow death may come, who knows? No bargain with death can keep the king of death away. So one who dwells thus ardently, relentlessly, day and night, it's that one who lives in a fortunate way. And so, yeah, no plan, no bargain can keep death away. But at the same time, it's the proper result is just kind of like Debbie was saying with King Pasenadi and the simile of the four mountains coming in from all sides. When you know it's coming and it's on the horizon, fearing it won't stop it. And fretting or being anxious or being morose or being sad, all of these things are, it's going to happen anyway. And what can we do but live by Dhamma, live righteously, and be cultivating paramita. So as time went on and this experience kind of settled in the heart, then yeah, I think one result is that I guess being understood isn't quite as important, or it's kind of like you know, interpersonal interactions that are difficult might be easier to let go of, because you just come back to this experience and thinking, well, the perspective is, you know, there's not really enough time to be holding grudges or be dwelling in negative mental states or irritation, aversion towards other people. So there's just not really enough time for that. But what there is time for is just cultivating the wholesome, building parami. We have dana parami, generosity. Kanti parami is just patient endurance. Yeah, banya parami, listening to teachings, yeah, perfection of wisdom. Yeah, metta parami, so cultivation of loving kindness. Upeka parami, equanimity. Then we have like aditana parami, which is perfection of aditana or determination, which is, that's an interesting one too, because it's like, it doesn't always mean like making an aditana, like I'm not going to drink coffee for a year or something like that. But it's also following through with things and doing things well. So determination, sila parami, you know, cultivation of precepts, virtue. Like a nekama parami, which is perfection of renunciation. And so, Satcha Parami, cultivation of truth. And so coming back to these, always being able to cultivate these perfections. And so on this retreat, it's just, in the big scheme of things, it's just a short period of time. But we have an opportunity to recollect these things and let them settle in the heart. And also just make best use of the time that we're given, specifically this period of time on retreat. So leave it there for now. You can take whatever is useful and leave behind whatever is not useful in that talk.
Sadhu, sadhu.